Chapter 33. Many of those who worshipped diligently on Sunday mornings became less faithful on Sunday nights. During my tour of churches, I heard many preachers chide their followers to return in a few hours to properly complete the observance of the Sabbath. I never counted heads, but as a general rule, about half of them did so. I tried a few Sunday night services, usually in an effort to catch some colorful ritual such as snake handling or disease healing, or on one occasion, a church conclave in which a wayward brother was to be put on trial and certainly convicted for fancying another brother's wife. My presence rattled them that night, and the wayward brother got a reprieve. For the most part, I limited my study of comparative religions to the daylight hours. Others had different Sunday night rituals. Harry Rex helped a Mexican named Pepe lease a building and open a restaurant one block off the square. Pepe's became moderately successful during the 1970s with decent food that was always on the spicy side. Pepe couldn't resist the peppers, regardless of how they scalded the throats of his gringo customers. On Sundays, all alcohol was banned in Ford County. It could not be sold at retail or in restaurants. Pepe had a back room with a long table and a door that would lock. He allowed Harry Rex and his guests to use the room and eat and drink all we wanted. His margaritas were especially tasty. We enjoyed many colorful meals with spicy dishes, all washed down with strong margaritas. There were usually a dozen of us, all male, all young, about half currently married. Harry Rex threatened our lives if we told anyone about Pepe's back room. The Clanton City Police raided us once, but Pepe suddenly couldn't speak a word of English. The door to the back room was locked and partially hidden, too. Pepe turned off the lights, and for 20 minutes we waited in the dark, still drinking, and listened to the cops try to communicate with Pepe. I don't know why we were worried. The city judge was a lawyer named Harold Finkley, who was at the end of the table slogging down his fourth or fifth margarita. Those Sunday nights at Pepe's were often long and rowdy, and afterward we were in no condition to drive. I would walk to my office and sleep on the sofa. I was there snoring off the tequila when the phone rang after midnight. It was a reporter I knew from the Big Daily in Memphis. "Are you covering the parole hearing tomorrow?" he asked. "Tomorrow?" In my toxic fog, I had no idea what day it was. "Tomorrow," I mumbled. "Monday, September the 18th, he said slowly. I was reasonably certain the year was 1978. "What parole hearing?" I asked, trying desperately to wake myself up and put two thoughts together. "Danny Padgett's. You don't know about it?" "Hell no. It's scheduled for 10 a.m. at Parchman." "You gotta be kidding." "Nope. I just found out. Evidently, they don't advertise these." I sat in the darkness for a long time, cursing once again the backwardness of a state that conducted such important matters in such ridiculous ways. How could parole even be considered for Danny Padgett? 8 years had passed since the murder and his conviction. He had received 2 life sentences for at least 10 years each. We assumed that meant a minimum of 20 years. I drove home around 3 a.m., slept fitfully for 2 hours, then woke up Harry Rex, who was in no condition to be dealt with. I picked up sausage biscuits and strong coffee, and we met at his office around 7. We were both ill-tempered, and as we plowed through his law books, there were sharp words and foul language, not aimed at each other, but at the blurry and toothless parole system passed by the legislature 30 years earlier. Guidelines were only vaguely defined, leaving ample wiggle room for the politicians and their appointees to do as they wished. Since most law-abiding citizens had no contact with the parole system, it was not a priority with the state legislature. And since most of the state's prisoners were either poor or black and unable to use the system to their advantage, it was easy to hit them with harsh sentences and keep them locked up. But for an inmate with a few connections and some cash, the parole system was a marvelous labyrinth of contradictory laws that allowed the parole board to pass out favors. Somewhere between the judicial system, the penal system, and the parole system, Danny Padgett's two consecutive life terms had been changed to two concurrent sentences. They ran side by side, Harry Rex tried to explain. "What good is that?" I asked.
"It's used in cases where a defendant has multiple charges. Consecutive might give him 80 years in jail, but a fair sentence is 10. So they run them side by side."
I shook my head in disapproval again, and this irritated him. I finally got Sheriff Trice McNatt to answer the phone. He sounded as hungover as we were, though he was a strict teetotaler. McNatt knew nothing about the parole hearing. I asked him if he planned to attend, but his day was already filled with important meetings. I would have called Judge Lupus, but he had been dead for 6 years. Ernie Gaddis had retired and was fishing in the Smoky Mountains. His successor, Rufus Buckley, lived in Tyler County, and his phone number was unlisted. At 8 o'clock, I jumped in my car with a biscuit and a cup of cold coffee.